The peerless film critic and essayist Roger Ebert passed away on April 4th of this year at the age of 70, leaving behind a legacy of wide-reaching influence on moviegoers the world over. Roger Ebert was a television mainstay for decades with his various movie review shows and wrote weekly film criticism for the Chicago Sun-Times for 46 years. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. For much of Roger Ebert's career at the Chicago Sun-Times, his editor and colleague was Laura Emmerich. Miss Emmerich will be a guest at this year's Plaza Classic Film Festival and will help remember the iconic critic with a special film series titled Ebert Everlasting, which presents some of Roger Ebert's favorite films. We re-air my conversation from April 12th of this year with Laura Emmerich about the life and legacy of one of the greatest of film critics, Roger Ebert. I thought we would start with maybe you could recap for us what's been going on in Chicago the last week as different events have been held to remember Roger Ebert.
Sure. It's really been a love fest, and it's been so heartening to see just the waves of emotion that have poured out toward Roger and his family, Chaz. Mm-hmm. You know, because he meant so much to the city. He was sort of the last, we like to say the last of the Sun-Times icons. There was Mike Royko, Murph Cupson and Ann Landers, and Roger, really. And it's a cliche, but it's the end of an era. Ebert Fest, the festival, now in its 15th year. And that also promises to be yet another celebration of his life and his love of films. And I've been told by the people at the festival that they plan to continue it to infinity and beyond.
Of course.
That even though he may not be with us anymore, his mission will be carried on through the festival and his supporters.
Great. It's writing the intro for this show and having to think of him in the past tense was really difficult, and I didn't even know him, but certainly the loss is fresh, so it's hard to think of him as gone. But I think it's also hard for us to think of him as gone because he left so much of himself behind.
Right. People have remarked that a lot of it was there in his book, but also he was a early proponent of the online experience. He was on CompuServe back in the 80s before most people even knew what the Internet or the World Wide Web was. And then, within the last 7 years since his illness, he took on this whole other role, basically as king of the blogosphere. He's notably celebrated for his online journal, Roger Ebert's Journal, and he received the Webby Person of the Year Award in 2010 for all his contributions to online journalism. And, you know, it came naturally to him, but also it gave him a voice when cancer took his. So now his site, RogerEbert.com, it's just had a redesign, and the plan is to continue that into the future as well. So even though he's no longer with us, all his reviews, his essays, his op-eds, they'll all be on his digital home.
It's really remarkable when you consider the battle he's had for almost a decade with cancer and the surgeries and, as you mentioned, that he lost the ability to speak. And this was someone who was first known to most of the world as a television film reviewer and was on every single week. For many of us growing up in the 70s and 80s, you know, he was a must-see. And that he would, in the midst of that infirmity, not only keep up his reviewing, but also expand his empire into this digital world that, as you say, gave him a new kind of voice.
And, you know, he never complained. That's the thing that amazed me. I would say, you know, Roger, you're so brave and you're just such an inspiration. He goes, well, I don't want to hear that. I don't want to think of myself as being courageous because I'm just doing what I need to do. And he was determined that would not be silenced. And I really think in a way he was even more determined and dedicated after he lost his voice because, you know, for so much of his life, he was really a raconteur. I mean, he'll talk about his days in the late 60s and 70s, even into the early 80s when he was really a fixture on the journalistic bar circuit here from Ricardo's to Old Town Ale. And that was before I knew him. But even so, when he would come into the features department back in the old building at 401 North Wabash, he would just kind of lead. He'd start, like, kind of cracking jokes when the elevator doors would open, and he wouldn't stop till he got to his office in the far corner of the features department. And he just loved to interact with people, and he was, you know, he wasn't Irish, but you would not know that from talking to him. I just had like that total natural gift of gab, and so for him, for his not being able to talk, that had to be such a.
So, how long did you work with Roger Ebert?
Well, actually, I've worked with him since the mid '80s. And then was his editor officially since 1994. So I've known him in various capacities through the years. So,
how does one edit Roger Ebert?
Well, it's interesting because I really looked at myself more as a facilitator or maybe a traffic cop. His copy came in pretty clean. And the thing that it's not like your average writer where you're like, oh, you need to take a different approach or, you know, your thesis is wrong. I mean, his copy came in and it was ready. You could almost push the button and it could run in print. But what was my role really is sort of maybe as a continuity person, maybe pointing out like, oh, you said this about that, and is this inconsistent now to say this? But also, when you're seeing, I think last year he said he wrote 300 reviews. I mean, that's a lot of material to digest. And in the old days, he used to have like a full-time assistant here to help him with all the various fact-checking and just the kind of nuts and bolts. And no one gets everything right, and so that's what I looked at myself as more doing. But also, he would receive so many requests to do interviews, and it was sort of my role to help kind of sift through all this.
You're the gatekeeper.
Kind of, yeah, exactly.
I'm curious thinking about him, and I know you're a film lover yourself, that it seemed part of his connection with his audience is that he was not just a critic. He could write academically, but throughout everything he wrote, you really got the sense that he loved movies.
Right. And, you know, I look back on his body of work, and it's interesting because it's like, there's like two extremes, as you said, the academic style criticism that
really a fanboy, I guess you call him.
Yeah, but he was not so consumerist that, you know, a lot of people just write about, okay, is this film worth your $10 this weekend?
Right.
I mean, he really took a middle ground, and I thought it was interesting last night. A lot of people touched on the theme that, you know, he really used the films or his reviews to kind of reflect what this means to the human experience. I mean, I know that sounds really lofty, but he tried to put everything in context. And, you know, it wasn't just about, do you like this film? Is it worth your time? It was just like, what does this film mean about us as human beings? I think one of his favorite quotes was like, the movies are a machine to generate empathy. They identify people who are sharing this journey with us. And then Michael Barker from Sony Pictures Classics, who was a longtime friend of Roger and Ebert Fest, and he said something along the similar lines. He said movies had the capacity to explain the complexity of human beings. We looked at films in different ways because of him. And I think that's really, when it comes down to it, that's his legacy and what kind of made him different than other people on the movie beat.
I think also going back to some of his reviews and comparing them to other reviewers at the time, that oftentimes critics fall into the trap of reviewing the film they wish they'd seen. And,
right.
And he always seemed to focus on the intent of the filmmaker and take that to its logical conclusion.
Absolutely. And he always said, you know, what audience was this film made? Some people would not understand why he could give like a high rating to something like really escapist and stupid, but if it met the criteria for that audience, he would judge it on those terms. And it's everything was relative to him. You know, it's funny because he's famous for the two thumbs up and also the whole star rating thing. And he didn't really, it was all loose and it was all fluid, and he didn't really want to be tied to that. I thought it was interesting that Scott Fondress from the Variety brought out last night, he said, thumbs and stars are just a means to an end. And it's so true. He didn't want to be boxed in.
I'm curious, since you knew him so long, I mean, you just mentioned that the thumbs up, which he and Gene Siskel sort of patented, and then the star system, which he was an early user of, did he ever worry that audiences or people reading his reviews would not get to the review. They would just see if he gave the thumbs up or gave it 3 stars and then move on to see the film.
Well, actually, he had said that a couple of times, and he was famous for saying, at least among his co-workers here, he wished we didn't have stars, the star rating system at all. Like the New York Times, they don't do that. Other papers, for a long time, resisted that. But really, I would say with an evolution of definitely the last 20 years, it's almost inescapable because,
right.
You know, with the rise of USA Today and everything's kind of...
reduced.
Exactly. Turned into a nugget soundbite. It was a lost cause to try to rail against it. And it's interesting because the star rating system we have here is 4 stars, based on 4 stars. And it's just everything below 2.5 is a negative review or therefore a thumbs down. And he only really had 3 gradations of thumbs up, 3, 3.5, and 4. And it was interesting because, like, as long as I was his editor, I said, Roger, couldn't we revisit this? Can't we just, because I thought, how can you have 5 incarnations of negativity, in essence? And he always came back to, like, well, you know, that's the way we've done it since, you know, he started back in '67, and we couldn't change the system because we'd have to change everything.
Hmm.
But, you know, many a review, he'd say, you know, I don't like stars, I don't want to give this a certain rating, but, you know, that was the system in which he was working, so.
I want to talk about Ebertfest. He started 15 years ago in Champaign-Urbana, his beloved hometown.
Right.
He was always a champion of directors, big and small. You know, he was an early fan of Scorsese. He's written a book on Scorsese, and Scorsese is in the process, I guess, of making a documentary about him,
right.
Werner Herzog. But I know from attending his festival with you and reading about it in the past, you know, he loved to use that festival to spotlight young talent that he thought everyone should know about. Mm-hmm. Ebertfest is obviously was always autobiographical in that, you know, these were films that Roger Ebert personally wanted to show audiences and connected with him. But this year, looking over the lineup, I think it might have been even more autobiographical than usual. We have he had programmed the 1958 Japanese film, beautiful Japanese film, Ballad of Narayama. Ebert, I guess, turned 70 this year, and the film is about a Japanese village whose custom is to take their 70-year-olds up on a mountain to die.
Right, yeah.
And then, of course, Days of Heaven, which he also programmed, the Terrence Malick film, which I think back in the 70s he called one of the most beautiful films ever made. I guess it was a Malick film that was the last film Roger Ebert reviewed.
Absolutely. It was To the Wonder, and it's just the whole symmetry. It's almost eerie, in a sense, because that was one of his, again, the filmmakers he had really supported throughout his career, and then to have that be his last review, it was almost too perfect.
I like to think of him in his final day just having a cinema in his head of all the beautiful images that he'd ever seen in his life, and certainly Terrence Malick would be right up there with him.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think maybe his own situation opened him up the last few years to, you know, other truths in cinema. I know I pulled from the closing of that review of To the Wonder, he wrote, "Seeking perfection, we see what our dreams and hopes might look like." And I think certainly taking into account the body of Roger Ebert's work, he knew what that dream was.
He was filtering movies through the prism of his life and helping us to relate our personal situations to the dreams and the magic captured on the film. I mean, it sounds kind of spacey or new agey, but really, you know, that's sort of what it all boiled down to for him, I thought.
Well, thank you for opening his life up to us. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us about your friend and colleague, Roger Ebert.
Thanks, Chuck.
You've been listening to a re-airing of my conversation with Roger Ebert's editor of many years at the Chicago Sun-Times, Laura Emmerich. Ms. Emmerich is attending this year's Plaza Classic Film Festival and has helped program the festival's celebration of Roger Ebert, a series of film screenings titled Ebert Everlasting. The series will present some of Roger Ebert's favorite films, including Fitzcarraldo, Citizen Kane, The Third Man, Tokyo Story, Goodfellas, La Dolce Vita, and one film he wrote the screenplay for, Russ Meyer's Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. The Plaza Classic Film Festival is underway until August 11th. The festival's special guest, actress Rita Moreno, will be signing her best-selling memoir from 1 to 3 p.m. today in the Foundation Room adjacent to the Plaza Theater, and will introduce and discuss the making of the 1981 film The Four Seasons at 3:30 p.m. today. For a complete listing of festival screenings and events, log on to plazaclassic.com. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. An archive of past programs is available on this station's website at ktep.org. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.